Accession number 18666, Reel 3.
Rheinbert, Reel 3.
Right, we're across the Indian Ocean, stopped at Colombo, and Ceylon as it was then, in Sri Lanka. Went ashore, great experience, rickshaws, people pulling rickshaws and so and then it was back on board and continued across the Indian Ocean, down the Malacca Straits to Singapore. Again, shore leave. Great. The scenes and sights and smells of the Orient. Brilliant. Staying outside Raffles Hotel, couldn't afford to go in, but it's a world renowned place. To stand outside there in Raffles Hotel, beyond our pockets, of course. But there was great experience. And this was the first time where I noticed the position of women in the Orient. They were building the new Nappy Club, the Nuffield Club in Singapore. And they had bamboo scaffolding. And the men were out at the top of the scaffolding laying the bricks, and it's the women who were taking the mortar up in baskets, acting as their labourers. Great experience then. And back on board again. And up to Hong Kong. Docked at Kowloon. Shore leave again. Great. Look at the shops and see the stuff. Go across on Star Ferry to Hong Kong Island. HM Forces can travel first class or second class fare. Made you feel a bit, didn't it? I look around Hong Kong and to see the loads that they carried as porters on bamboo canes. Incredible. Whereas we put stuff on trucks, they would carry them on bamboo canes. Boxes and boxes of stuff. Incredible. Of course, a dress. All very interesting. We had 12 hours ashore at Hong Kong. And then it was back on board again. Across the China Sea, and after a few days I came up on board one morning and the engines had stopped and we were anchored off the coast of Korea, South Korea, my first view of Korea, hills, and then it was down for breakfast, pack kit, up on deck again in time when we came into dock. Great excitement, really, I felt. An American army band arrived, started playing tunes. If I knew you were coming, we'd bake a cake, more things like that. And then it was time to disembark. We'd taken in trucks to a local British army camp, just on the outskirts of Busan. And we were there for a couple of days, being kitted out with different types of boots, string vests and things. And then we were taken to the railway station and on board an American military train. It was called the USAC Express, and I only found out what the USAC stood for not long ago, and it was 8th US Army Corps. There was a diesel train and we left Busan, went up through Taegu, Taejon to Seoul. That took us best part of a day. We got to Seoul somewhere tea time, and travelling through the Korean countryside, there were signs of war, railway engines on their side off the tracks all shot up and things like that. And then we got to Seoul and it was quite devastated, and we stayed there one night. And then we were back on the train and down to the station again. And I remember that the facade of that station is still exactly the same. 40-odd years after, as it was then. Anyway, on the train, across the Han River, and you see all the old bridges where they've been destroyed and built and destroyed again. And travelling north all the time until we came to the Commonwealth Division Zone, where we disembarked. Sorry, we un-distrained or
detrained.
Taken to the Royal Signals camp. And I was in a tent that night, and I had to sleep on the floor. There wasn't enough beds. It's always the same. If there wasn't enough beds, it was always I had to sleep on the floor. With our mosquito nets, we had to put our mosquito nets up. And I was talking to this chap, and he said, "Don't, you're all right, as long as the rats don't bite you." He said, "If you get the rats, you get bubonic plague." Of course, he was having me on a little bit, you know. But the place was quite infestated with rats. And he felt a bit sorry, but he said to me afterwards, he said, "Look, when you go for your interview tomorrow morning, tell him you want to go on detachment." I had no idea what he was talking about, really. But he said, "You believe me, otherwise you'll be stuck in a place like this." So we go for interview next morning for the officer. And I said, "I want to go out on detachment." He said, "You've been speaking to somebody." I said, "No, I haven't." I said, he said, "Well, I don't know if I can." I said, "I'd like to go out on detachment." Now, I had no idea really what it involved. But he said, "I can't guarantee it." Anyway, the next day, two or three of us were taken down to what I turned out to be Rear Div. I spent 2 days there. The first day, I was put in charge of some cranes. And these were all old people, because the cranes of military age were in their forces. These were all old papasans, as we called them, with their little beards and hats. They were filling small sacks out with rocks, and we were building a little roadway for the camp. There was a young lad of about 14 or 15 who was acting as interpreter. And we would go and get these rocks, fill these sacks up and put them down and build this little roadway. This lad said to me, "They want to stop now." I said, "Well, we haven't been going long. They want to stop," he says, "for a cigarette." So I said, "Right, we'll stop for a cigarette." And they say the day went on, really. They did as much as they wanted to. And the next day, I forget what I was doing. I finished it lunchtime the next day, and the chap in the tent said to me, he was posted at this place, he said, "It was a lovely day," because it was August now, beginning of August. He said, "Do you fancy a swim?" I said, "Well, I wouldn't mind." He said, "Well, if I can okay it with the sergeant, we'd go out the Indian River for a swim," he says. So I said, "You sure it's all right?" "Yes," he said, "I'm going to ask the sergeant." He came back, he said, "That's all right." He said, "Don't need no costumes or anything, of course." He said, "Just go." So we walked out of the camp, down the road to the main road. We were up a side road. To the main road. Up to lift, the first truck to start was an American truck. Jumped on the back, "Where are you going?" "Imjin River." "All right." They stop. We pass the 38th parallel marker that all the Americans pile out for photographs, right? And then they drop us off at the Indian River, which is above the 38th parallel, you see, at Pintail Bridge. Now, Pintail Bridge was the main bridge through the British Commonwealth Zone across the Indian River. It's only one track width, right? But that was the main road into the Commonwealth Division. We jumps off the truck. We go down, there's a nice bit of sandy beach. And on the way up, this chap has said to me, "Don't get out too far. There's holes in the Indian River, and there's swirly currents, and it's quite treacherous. You're all right if you keep close in." We walk down to the sandy shoreline, and then just dragging a bloke out, you know, and I think he was dead. Which is a bit of a shaker, really, because, you know,
He'd been swimming, hadn't he?
He'd been swimming, yeah. It was quite... it was safe enough if you knew what you did, but people tended to get a bit silly, you know. And unfortunately, he was dead. But that didn't deter me from going in. I went in, had a swim, kept close into the shore, and it was very refreshing. And then it was back. Next day, I was taken out to my posting, which was above the Imjin River on the main supply route up to the front line in the Commonwealth Division. It was an ammunition point, ammunition depot, and it was run by the 23 Canadian Transport Company. There was a driver and another wireless operator there when I first arrived, but the driver was repatriated home shortly afterwards, so that just left myself and another wireless operator. The wireless was open from 7 in the morning till 10 at night, and 1 week I would do morning and evening shift, the next week I would do the afternoon shift. Occasionally we had to stay open all night, and one evening I was on the set when things were a bit lively out the front, and the regiments were coming in for ammunition and quite consistently. So we were on call all night and until well into the early hours of the morning. But then it all seemed to die down, and the problem then was staying awake. To sit in a wireless truck, a small wireless truck, all by yourself, 3 o'clock in the morning, with just mush coming out your earphones.
What do you mean, mush coming out your
earphones? Earphones. Mush is the noise you get, like static. There's difficulty to keep awake. And of course, the penalties for falling asleep while you're on watch were quite severe if you got caught. It was generally known that the punishment for that would be probably a month in the military corrective establishment in Korea, which by all accounts was a very unhealthy place to be in. Anyway, my time there with the Canadians was quite good. I quite enjoyed it. They were very nice hosts. The food was much better than we received in the British Army. And occasionally they would come round with free packets of cigarettes. And at one time we had a free bottle of beer for some evenings, all donated by the Korean forces in Canada. We just did our turn on the set. The traffic consisted mainly of recording ammunition issues to different regiments. And this would be radioed back down to rear echelon, and then replenishments sent up to the ammunition depot to replace that stuff that had been issued. Generally, we kept fairly busy, and especially when there was a lot of activity in the front line, it was quite busy. One day, a jeep rolled up with a driver and says, you've got to go up to the North Ammunition Depot for a week. So I climbed aboard this jeep with me bits and pieces. No bed, no camp bed. I just took my washing gear and so forth. And I was taking out of the valley, northward, towards the front line, to a smaller ammunition depot where I spent the week. Just after I got there, on the way up, by the way, we passed a Royal Artillery unit that were blasting away with a 25-pounders at some target that I couldn't see beyond the hill, and the air was quite acrid with gunpowder and smoke. And I arrived at this other ammunition depot, and it was quite peaceful there at the time. And then all of a sudden, there was an almighty bang, which made me startle. That's all right, Limey, says one of the Canadians. It's only the Yanks with their big toms just over the side of the hill. And these guns would go off intermittently without warning. Unless you were prepared, they were a little bit frightening. After a week, I was back down to my normal posting at the South Ammunition Point. This was situated at the base of at the end of a valley. The main supply route to the combative came in from the left, across the front of our ammunition depot, then veered to the left, up the side of the valley, and out through an escarpment at the top. Then one evening at tea time, it was quite light, explosions occurred at the head of the valley where the Indian Field Ambulance Unit was encamped. This causes a bit of consternation because the shells then started creeping down the valley. And on our right was the Royal Norfolk's Regiment. They had just come out of the front line and were encamped in tents on the hill to our right. Now, unfortunately, some shells landed amongst their tent lines and they suffered casualties. I thought this was a bit of hard luck, really, because these lads had just spent a 12-month on active service. They'd just come out the front line, and were expecting to go back to Pusan any minute to be transferred home, and then to suffer casualties at that end of their service was very unfortunate. The shells continued to fall down the valley. There was nothing in the centre of the valley except paddy fields and a Korean house, where there were some Korean men. They soon abandoned their house and scarpered back down the road towards Pintail Bridge. There were no women, Korean women, above the Imjin River at that time, but there were Korean males who did chores for the various army units. Another night, again about tea time, we saw American warplanes diving down and dropping bombs. Clouds of black smoke ensued as they pulled away. We could only assume that this was napalm they were using. Terrible stuff, really, but war's a terrible thing. Again, at a later date, I was sent down to another unit below the Indian River, a Rimi unit, to do a stand-in for somebody going on leave. While I was there, Carol Carr, the singer and entertainer, was on camp, but unfortunately I couldn't get to see her performance. I had to remain on duty on the wireless set. I did see Frankie Harrod, Eve Boswell, in one show, and Ted Ray and somebody else in another show. And these shows were very much appreciated by the troops out there. It just gives a bit of light entertainment in amongst while we're doing our duties. I was with the Canadians for 3.5 months, a time which I enjoyed, really, because I was doing a job that I'd been trained to do. I was doing a worthwhile job. You felt you were doing something useful. And our Canadians were good hosts. But unfortunately, after about 3.5 to 4 months, I got posted to the 5th Dragoon Guards. The reason being that some of their national servicemen, their group number was up, and they had been sent home for demobilisation. So myself and about 5 other Royal Signals personnel were attached to the 5th Dragoon Guards in addition to their already units that were already there. Now, with the 5th Dragoon Guards, it was different type of wireless messages because I was on the command set. I used to work the command set in the regimental headquarters, and there were 5th Dragoon Guards people who did the same work, but they had Royal Signals there, one presumes, in case at some time they wanted to had to change the Morse code, because Royal Signals wireless operators were trained in Morse code, whereas the 5th Dragoon operators were only changing voice. So we were in the command post. They always had a Royal Signals personnel on duty in the command post, along with a Fiscoon Guards person. Very interesting work, because we had direct contact with the tanks in the front line. And whenever the tanks were shelled or mortared, they would give us shell reps and mortar reps, which we would take down and then immediately pass to the Royal Artillery Counter Bombardment Unit for retaliation purposes. And they would also describe what's going on immediately around them in the front line regards action. At this time, there was quite a substantial action on the a feature they called the Hook. And the Black Watch were the regiment dug in on the... And one of the tanks during the Chinese offensive, this was in November 1952, one of the 5th Dragoon tanks got a direct hit, and the driver was trapped in his cab, and it was difficult to get the tank back down out of the forward position, but it was managed to everybody's relief. So again, it was quite interesting work, and felt again you were doing something worthwhile and involved in something. Unfortunately, we found out when we got to the 5th Dragoon Guards that their time of duty in Korea was almost expired. In about 6 to 7 weeks' time, their time was up and they were going back to Egypt. We inquired, what about us? And they said that all attached personnel would have to go with them. So that would be the Royal Signals, Remy, whoever was attached, would go back with the regiment to Egypt. This I was rather disappointed, because I hadn't completed my time in Korea, and also I hadn't had my R&R leave in Tokyo. I was told, well, that's unfortunate. All attached personnel have to go back with the 5th Dragoon Guards. So, just before Christmas 1952, instead of going to Tokyo for my R&R leave, I was on a troop ship going from Korea back to Hong Kong, Singapore, Ceylon, Aden to Port Said. Going back wasn't half as exciting as going out. In fact, I felt a little bit depressed, because I felt I was doing a good job in Korea, doing a worthwhile job, and I didn't really want to leave. But on the other hand, I consoled myself with I was going to another country, and I will see another country, Egypt. We get to Port Said. We get on a train. We entrain, and we're going south again along the canal. And we stop at Ismailia station. We had instructions on no account to get off the train, because Egypt at that time, the Egyptians had been in uprising the year before, and they expected trouble. In fact, the Egyptians weren't very friendly. And we stopped at the station at Ismailia, and I opened the carriage window, and a little Arab boy's come along trying to sell you peanuts. "You buy peanuts, Johnny. Johnny, buy peanuts." And I said, "No, thank you." And stood beyond him towards the back of the platform. There was a lot of Arabs. Was this other older Arab in his 30s? He said, "You Englishmen step off that train, I'll kill you," he said. I thought, charming fellow. I closed the window and stepped back into the carriage. But that was the attitude of the Arabs. The contrast between the little boy trying to make a penny and his bigger brother wanting to kill me. We carried on down it, and we detrained. And we ended up at Shandor Camp, which is on the shores of the Little Bitter Lake. Now, this was a bit of a sprawling camp. and no wireless operating to do. And so signals, wireless operating signals, we were employed on either operating the camp telephone exchange, which none of us had much experience on. And if you push the button in the wrong way, the colonel got a ring back in his ear, which he didn't like. Or repairing and maintaining the telephone system, which was in a bit of a dire strait. So that was our duties, mainly repairing the telephones. All our jungle green equipment had been replaced, and we now had home office pattern webbing, which had to be blancoed, and the brasses cleaned. We'd had a new troop sergeant attached to us from the Royal Signals. He hadn't been to Korea with us. So he said, "What colour we got to do our webbing, Sarge?" "Royal Signals green or cavalry buff?" "You better do it cavalry buff," he says, seeing as we're attached to the cavalry. So all our signals that weekend, we get the necessary buff blanco, do our big packs, small packs, belts, everything else that had to be blancoed, clean the brasses. Later on in the week, he comes and he says, "You done all your blanco buff?" "Yes, Sarge." "Sorry, that's wrong. You got to do it Royal Signals green." And we had to scrub all our webbing equipment clear of buff blanco and redo it all in Royal Signals green. Next night, I go on guard duty. And then the fifth green officer says to me, "What have you got green blanco? Well, everybody else has got buff." And I said, "Because our troop sergeant said we had to do it Royal Signals green." So that was that. Guard duties. In Korea, I never had to do guard duties because we had to do shifts on the set at night time. In Egypt, we had to do guard duties. I felt the sergeant could have got us off guard if he wanted to. But no, we had to join 5th Dragoon Guards and do our share of guard duties. And I used to hate guard duties, not because of the actual doing the guard. It's the lack of sleep. I always liked my sleep. One thing I couldn't stand up at Gallagate was guard duties, because lack of sleep again, missing sleep. And here, down in Egypt, maintaining guard at 6 o'clock, it was 2 on, 4 off. Depends which stag you got. The middle one was the worst, because it was from 8 to 10, and then it was from 2 to 4. The first and last stags weren't too bad. First stag was, everybody wanted the first stag because you went on from 6 to 8 and you had a 4-hour break, then you did 12 to 2 and you came off at 2, you could get 3 or 4 hours sleeping before 6 o'clock, you see. But otherwise, if you had the other, if you did the middle shift, you got, you get an hour sleep, then you got woken up and had to go eat and do your 2-hour stag and then perhaps try and get an hour sleep when you come back in.